Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay, hello everybody. It's nice to be here tonight. Thank you, Ajahn Puna, for letting me come here, and thank you for inviting me to give the Dhamma talk. Yeah, so I have been here once before. This was seven-ish years ago. I spent about a month here. And that was recently after I had been given my independence as a monk. Monks need to train for the first 5 years with a teacher, and they do this period of dependence. It's called the Nisaya period. And I had been released from that recently by Ajahn Viradamo of Tisarna. And my first outing, you know, travel around, was to come here. And yeah, it was good times. Do you remember that young man, Thomas, who rolled that Subaru car in the ditch? Yeah, that happened on that trip. Nobody got hurt. It was okay. The car was totaled, but insurance covered 90% of it, so that was a miracle. It was a very good visit, by the way. I don't want to portray it as a bad time. It was actually a very good time, other than that. Yeah, and I want to say thank you so much for that time too. That was a very good time for meditation for me. And yeah, that was kind of the start of some traveling around. You know, it's normal for monks to go traveling during their kind of so-called middle monk years, when they have 5 year seniority up to 10 years roughly, the so-called Majjhima years, the middle years. And traditionally in Thailand, this is done by walking around just with your bowl and a shoulder bag and this sort of like folded up umbrella and maybe a tea kettle. You know, this was done in the kind of like ancient jungles of Thailand and between villages and such. These days, it's not quite as romantic an experience anymore, what with modern highways and baking asphalt in the, you know, tropical heat, and you know, it's not quite as lovely as it used to be. You know, you used to be under kind of a big jungle canopy a lot of times when you were walking in the forest. Now there aren't as many remote places. There are still some, but I've talked to monks who've done that kind of a tudong. They call it a tudong. I never did do a tudong like that. I developed some pretty serious knee problems, which would have made that not work out well. But nonetheless, I still traveled around from place to place and met many new monks and saw several new monasteries and learned a whole bunch of new things. So I was thinking tonight I'll try to share just some random anecdotes, things I learned, interesting things. And to me, that's highly valuable, you know, just to gain more exposure to Buddhism, because it's such a rich tradition, you know, such a rich religion. Now, mind you, I stayed in the Theravada world for virtually all that time, you know, up till now. But even within the Theravada world, there is quite a lot of diversity, a lot of, I stayed with not just Ajahn Chah lineage monasteries, but I also stayed with two major Sri Lankan traditions for quite some time. One is called the Mahamevana tradition, and the other one is called the Geldua tradition. These are two very major traditions in Sri Lanka, and this is, you know, there are several traditions there, but those are probably the two biggest ones that I'm aware of, with the most number of monks. I also spent some time with, in a couple of associated monasteries with the Pa'ok Saedaw tradition. Those were in Malaysia. So I traveled to Sri Lanka. I spent a little over a year in Sri Lanka. I spent a little over a year in Australia on two visits. I went to the USA for about half a year, and I went to Malaysia for a little over a year and a half. I went to Thailand for just a little bit, just a couple of months. And yeah, well, Singapore for a short time, just a few weeks. And, you know, a lot of my training was very applicable no matter where I went in the Theravada world. And I'm very grateful for all the Vinaya training that we get in the Ajahn Chah lineage. Like, the Ajahn Chah lineage is quite strict on Vinaya. And wherever I went, you might say that that Vinaya was almost like my passport. You know, even when I went out of my own tradition, these other traditions knew the Ajahn Chah lineage and they knew that we had good Vinaya. And that oftentimes would kind of get me in the door, you know, where they would let me stay. You know, I was able to make some connections too, which definitely helped. Yeah, so that's that I'm very grateful for. And yeah, most of these places I just mentioned, they have very similar Vinaya conformance, maybe some minor issues, minor differences, but probably 90, 95% of that Vinaya was all the same. Now, there was some really interesting differences in their cultures, like little differences in their lifestyle. And like basically each of these ethnic Asian countries you go to, their local culture tends to intermingle quite a lot with Buddhism, which is totally understandable. Now, you know, as I met different ethnic Asian monks, they are practicing Buddhism as they have known it for many centuries, and they have a strong sense of wanting to preserve Buddhism, you know, preserve the sasana, as they say. Sasana is this word meaning like a procession of monks and nuns, you know, originating right back to the Buddha. And yeah, so they have a, to them it's not just a religion, it's it also includes their culture too. Like their culture is kind of on board with that, you know. And now each place I went, you know, the culture could vary somewhat, you know what I mean? Like when I was in Sri Lanka, for example, there were some definite Hindu influences in their cultural understanding of Buddhism. Like, okay, just one kind of fun example is like in the Ajahn Chah lineage, when we ordain, you know, we get our bowl, our robes, you know, basic monk requisites, and we also get this metal spoon. So if you look over at the John Puna's bowl, he's got this metal spoon kind of wedged between the lid and the bowl. So we all get this metal spoon. And I would only come to learn later on, you know, a little bit about the history of that. It appears to have originated from China. That's how the Chinese make their soup spoons. But the Thais inherited this from the Chinese because they're, you know, Thailand is kind of in like the Indochina region, so they're, you know, they're going to take a lot of influence both from China and from India. You know, Thailand's almost like this cultural mixing pot between India and China. You know, those two cultures come in. Intermingle there. Anyway, so when I went to Sri Lanka, no spoon. And how they eat is they just use their hand. And I'm like, what? Like, why? You know, just personally to myself, I'm like, why wouldn't you use a utensil? You know, like, come on. Like, we all know about bacteria. We, you know, but no, that is how the Buddha ate. The Buddha had no spoon. So darn it, they are going to also copy the Buddha and they're gonna not eat with a spoon, you know? Now, there is no Vinaya rule around this spoon thing. Like, there is nowhere in there which says, okay, you either must not eat with a spoon or any utensil or spoons are allowed. You know what I mean? It just doesn't say. It just remains silent on this issue. By the way, spoons were known. Spoons do get mentioned the odd time here and there. But it is never a point of Vinaya that I'm aware of. I'm 99% sure there's pretty much nowhere in the Vinaya. And yeah, it's more of just a cultural custom. Like that's how everybody did it back then. Or at least, you know, in the Sangha, that's how everybody did it. And Yeah, so I feel this makes an interesting example of like, it is not part of the Buddhist doctrine that you have to eat with your hands. Eating with your hands is not going to help you attain nibbana, in my opinion. You know, whether you eat with a spoon or with your hand, it does not hinge upon that whether you're going to attain nibbana or not, okay? But a lot of the more, how can I put this? A lot of monks feel a strong sense of almost like cultural pride, you could say, where they're like, no, we will preserve every little thing about our culture because don't change it. Like they are very conservatively minded. And okay, I can respect that, you know, especially as a lot of these countries become more and more westernized. It is, I say, well and good that they do preserve any aspect of their culture, which, how can I put this? Helps them to avoid some of the, like, you might say, less excellent aspects of our own culture. You know, there's a lot of great things that come along with our Westerner culture, but there are some, you might say, disadvantages which come along with our culture as well. And if they're able to avoid those disadvantages, I say, well and good. Anyway, I continued eating with my spoon, and they were okay with that. Nobody made me stop, you know. So, but there are many such things like this where, how can I put it? It's not really a point of doctrine, but nonetheless, they really want to follow their own, you know, they want to stay true to their heritage, their cultural heritage. So yeah, it was just really interesting to see a lot about that, like with the Sri Lankans. You see a lot of Ayurvedic knowledge in how they eat or how they use medicine, you know, a lot of natural herbs, natural healing, this sort of thing. Some of them are really quite into that. This one monastery I stayed at, Nauyana, they had an entire, oh, I would call it like an apothecary. Like it was a large room, almost as big as this room we're in, maybe half, two-thirds the size of this room, just with all sorts of herbs in it. Like they had herbs drying tied to the ceiling, and you know, they had these giant mortar and pestles, and they were grinding herbs, and you know, they must have had like 80 different herbs in there. Like just all sorts of things I'd never seen in my life. And it was amazing. You know, they you know, there was quite a science to all this. It was yeah, that was really quite like I just felt like I stepped in a time machine, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, that was amazing. So yeah, it was interesting to see how these culture elements combined with Buddhism. Like when I went to Malaysia, okay, now it's kind of a different story where virtually all the Buddhists there are of Chinese descent. Like they are basically immigrants from China, you know, from some point in the past. Just as we Westerners, you know, a lot of us are going to have roots back in Europe, you know, this sort of thing. Like I've got ancestors from Britain and like Ukraine and Germany and Hungary. You know, I'm kind of this European mutt almost, you know. Anyway, so there are Chinese people from a number of regions of China in Malaysia, not just one. So there are several different Chinese languages, which some of them still speak at home. Like there's not just Mandarin, they're, you know, the official language of China, but there's like Hokkien, there's Cantonese, there's probably a couple other minor ones too. Like there's, you know, there's not just one uniform type of Chinese person there. There's several kind of like sub ethnicities of Chinese people there. Yeah, very multicultural there. There's a Malay language, they can speak that too. The older generation, who's kind of our age, they can speak English because Britain colonized Malaysia, which was great. I could speak English there. I probably had the easiest time, you know, in Asia with you know, just communicating because of that. Yeah, and they tend to be by default kind of like Mahayana, from a Mahayana background, usually Chinese Chan. And also some kind of folk Chinese beliefs too. Like there's kind of like okay, like sometimes I'd go for a donna meal at somebody's house and they'd kind of have a shrine in their house And there would be these three kind of like Chinese ancestors. There's Fu, Lu, and Shu. Have you heard of these before? Fu, Lu, and Shu. Or they call it like, I can hardly pronounce it, but like Fuzi, Shuzi, and Fuzi, Luzi, and Shuzi. Yeah. And the I actually did a Dhamma talk once. Like I looked this up on Wikipedia and kind of what they stand for. And one of them's kind of like the god of wealth. One's the god of wisdom. The other one, oh, was he the god of longevity? I can't remember. I can't remember exactly. But the god of wisdom, he actually was pretty close to Buddhism, right? And I said, of these three deities you have, this one's actually pretty close to Buddhism. He stands for wisdom. Buddhism also has a strong tradition about wisdom, Panya. I kind of made a Dhamma talk out of that, and like, oh, they really appreciate that. And this wise man Shu, he's oftentimes holding these pink peaches kind of on a branch, these pink peaches. And I'm like, do you know what those peaches stand for? And they're like, oh yes, those give you long life. And I'm like, and also too, they symbolize immortality. There's a famous I knew this because I read a book, Journey to the West, which is a famous book where this famous character in the book, this monkey, he basically goes to a heavenly realm and steals these peaches, which are only available to the gods, but he steals them and eats them and gains immortality. So whenever you see any kind of a pink peach in any kind of a Chinese thing, that's a symbol for immortality. Yeah, so I don't know, I just found it interesting how these different cultures and traditions kind of influence each other. And Malaysia is quite a crossroads of different cultures. They've also got about 10% of their population and comes from an Indian background as well. Like sometimes we'd go on an alms round in like a market, and not only the Chinese would donate things to us, but the Indians too. Even though they're not really Buddhist, they're Hindu, but they will recognize us as being like sadhus, like being holy men. And yeah, they are willing to feed Buddhist monks, not just their own Hindu monks, which is pretty neat. Oh, I'm just rambling here. I'm just rambling. Yeah, it was very interesting, all these travels. Oh, well, I could talk a little about Vinaya, but that might be kind of boring. Okay, here's something I'll dwell on, and a bit of a conversation struck up just earlier tonight before the Dhamma talk. One of the attendees was saying she first started with Tibetan Buddhism and how very ceremonious it all was compared to Theravada Buddhism. There tends to be much less ceremony, or very little. And yeah, for one, I've never really been a fan of ceremony. And what really drew me to reading the suttas, and especially the early Buddhist texts, is how it is very unadorned. It doesn't have a bunch of flowery language and a bunch of vague, kind of mystical language. It tries to be as simple and clear as possible, and that really appealed to me. That appealed to my kind of more pragmatic side, more kind of rational side. And now, what I see back at the time of the Buddha is the dominant religion here. Maybe I'll just pause my little story and say thank you so much to Ajahn Punardamo for his Dhamma talks he does, where he delves into more of the background context of Buddhism back at the time of India. What were the customs like? What was India like? That provides lots of context. I feel that's very valuable, and it helps to sort out a lot of these cultural differences when we look at that context. Very valuable. And it can help us to find the commonalities between these different Buddhist traditions, to kind of sort out what is a cultural thing and what is an actual doctrine thing, and find those commonalities. That I think will help a lot to help the different Buddhist traditions get along with each other and agree with each other more, understand each other. Okay, so what I see in the suttas when I read the early Buddhist texts is the dominant religion at the time was that of Brahmanism, and these days that's called Hinduism. And they were very into ceremonies back then. It was all about doing big sacrifices and big rituals. And if they were done right, you could get the gods to do things for you. Okay. The Brahmins were sort of like, you could say, middlemen between the sort of common folk and the gods. And these Brahmins could do ceremonies to, let's say, help a family conceive a son or something like this. You know, they were kind of the middlemen who talked to God through their ceremonies or gods. And I feel that the Buddha was very critical of them in a number of places all throughout the Pali Canon. I think he was, how can I put this? The Buddha displays a knowledge of how there were seekers and sages in India's ancient history, even before the Buddha, like go back centuries, even before the Buddha. And the Buddha knew about a number of those seekers and sages and what they practiced, what they could do. They were much more into, a contemplative kind of lifestyle. They did forms of meditation. Some of them had even psychic powers, this sort of thing. It doesn't go into great detail that I'm aware of. Maybe a John Poonam would know more about just what those ancient seekers and sages did, but the Buddha was aware of them and kind of how pure of a lifestyle they led, what their sort of like code of conduct was like, their discipline, their observances, kind of how pure their lifestyle was, what sorts of immoral behaviors that they would avoid, etc., which acted as a foundation for their striving, And then when he compared those ancient seekers and sages to the Brahmins of his day, which were very ceremonious and had a whole bunch of questionable morality left, right, and center, the Buddha actually like lambastes them in a number of occasions, saying like, look, you guys used to have all sorts of discipline. And even like names a bunch of these seekers and sages by name. He says like, look at this ancient guy and that ancient guy, and I can't list them all, and he's like, look what you've become now, and especially at the start of the Digha Nikaya, the first 13 suttas in the Digha Nikaya, the so-called silas, there are a number of those suttas where the Buddha just rips into them. And when I look at how the Buddha ran the Sangha, at least this is in very early Buddhism, the ceremonies were like absolutely bare minimum. Like, I mean, bare minimum. And to me, that was almost like, I believe what he was doing there was, it was like a strong reaction to how ceremonious all those Brahmins had become. It was a strong reaction of like, no, we're not doing all that ceremony stuff. We're just going to focus on the things that really matter in a holy life. Getting the foundation of morality straight and things like, that which actually matters when you want to attain Nibbana. Starting off with things like generosity, dana, this sort of thing. Getting these basics together, being kind, being caring. And then meditation, of course, and the Brahmaviharas, samadhi, this kind of thing. And yeah, he is not into ceremony. If you read the early Buddhist texts, it's very unadorned. Like when he would ordain a monk, at least when the Buddha personally ordained a monk at first, the ceremony just consisted of saying "Ehi Bhikkhu," which meant "Come, monk," and that's it. That was an ordained monk now. Like if some monk wanted to ordain and he met the very few qualifications you had to meet, the monk would just say to you like, "Ehi Bhikkhu," and that's it, you're ordained. That's your ordination ceremony. So that is powerful. It's two words, Now, mind you, this ceremony has grown somewhat these days. It takes all of an hour or two to do this ordination ceremony. It's a little more, you could say, legalistic. But still, I would say it is still a tight ceremony. When you look at the actual words that are spoken, the actual procedure done, there's not a wasted sentence anywhere in there, in my opinion. It's not, I say it isn't frivolous, When you look at translations of virtually all of the transactions, so-called, that we do as monks, they're very minimalistic. Like when we do confessions, for example, it's just a very straightforward, a monk confesses what he's done. That's an offense. The other one says, "Do you see your offense?" "Yes, I do." "You should try to be more restrained in the future." "Okay, thank you, venerable sir." Like it's pretty much that. That is pretty much it. There might be just a few more words than that. Yeah, very minimalistic ceremony. Now, Buddhism has, as I'm sure all of you are aware, grown much more ceremonious in all these many centuries that have passed, in a bunch of the different, lineages and traditions and whatnot. And for quite a while, I kind of puzzled over this, and I was like, why would they do that? Why would, isn't that like not being true to the spirit of what the Buddha wanted? But I had to contemplate this for a long time, and I think that there is some value to ceremony. Okay, so this is just me talking here. This is just my own, this is one of my findings I almost want to present to you, okay, for what it's worth, after all this journeying around and seeing all these traditions. This is one of the things I've come up with, okay, to help me understand is I did some studying of Confucius and Confucianism. And one of his big teachings is it's called Li, like Li, okay? And I'm definitely not saying it with the right intonation there, but like Li, okay? Li. And this is an important aspect of Confucianism, and it is that of ritual. It is that of ceremony, okay? And in Confucianism, like ceremony is very important, and there's all sorts of things they do, let's say at a funeral or a bunch of other occasions. There are important rites and rituals that you do, and they're very solemn and they're very careful. And it seems that to hear Confucianism tell it, you need li, you need ritual as a means of gluing a community together. Okay? Ritual can be a way of gluing a community together, providing almost like a binding agent to bring the people together. And when I learned a bit more about the history of Confucianism, I think I can understand why this is, again, just sort of my sense here. Why would he be big into ritual? Okay, like he loved ritual. Confucius just loved it. At his particular time in the past in China, there were a bunch of like warring tribes. There was a lot of bloodshed. There was a lot of chaos. There was a lot of just unpredictability, as to would the government hold together? Would society hold together? You know what I mean? Would people be sort of torn away from their livelihoods or torn away from their whatever was familiar in their lives, There was a lot of just tribes trying to take over and establish a dynasty, And right at the time of his life, one particular dynasty was sort of overthrown and a new dynasty established. And I think a lot of the sort of rigidness that came out of Confucianism, which very much has to do with a lot of ritual, is that ritual provided, you might say, some stability in their society when they really needed it. They needed it from something or other. You know what I mean? They needed a way which just sort of settled down this chaos and settled down this unpredictability from all this war and stuff. And if you could get people to all kind of do the same thing, follow the same rituals, that had a stabilizing effect on the society. And it gave people a sense of like what their proper place was and what the proper behaviors were, like let's say to your elders or whatever, showing them respect. This sort of gave everyone a clear sense of what was proper behavior. And yeah, so that kind of stabilizing force, I think, was something much needed for them. And when it had like a religious, shall we say, a specialness to it, people were far more willing to conform to it because it would be like betraying your religion to not do it. You know what I mean? When it has a religious importance, it's kind of almost sacrilegious to not do it, right? So to me, that's one of the biggest values of this Li thing. It's when you live in a chaotic world, ceremony can can give people a sense of belonging and a sense of comfort and a sense of everyone sort of knew their place, how they fit into that society, you know? Everyone had a role. There were expectations that came along with your kind of position in society and your lot in life. Yeah, so to me, that can be one of the big reasons to have all this ceremony is for that reason. And definitely, I was just staying with a Sri Lankan tradition, and they do quite a lot more ceremony there. And I can kind of appreciate how all that ceremony did provide, you might say, a glue to hold that community together. Like I was just in a place just north of Calgary called Ehipasiko, and there's quite a number of Sri Lankan immigrant families in Calgary. So they've become to this, at least pre-COVID anyway, when you could all come together more freely, they would all come together, and they felt that sense of togetherness because they would do all these same ceremonies back from how they did in Sri Lanka. Yeah, so that's to me that's one of the big values of ceremony. And another big learning as well, what a lot of these ceremonies are all talking about, how can I put this? They virtually always have some element of sacrifice in them, okay? Making an offering where you sacrifice something. So even for us to burn candles and incense, we it's like we're sacrificing the candles to the altar, or the incense. We are we could have used those candles and incense back in our kutis and not used them here. This is quite a mild version of it, but like the Sri Lankans, they make offerings of food to the Buddha statue. They do this thing called the Buddha Puja. They offer food, like breakfast and lunch and drinks in the afternoon too. 3 times a day, they make offerings, and this is a form of sacrifice. And by the way, that to me has quite a strong Hindu influence. The Hindus do this too. Only they're making these offerings to their own favorite deities, such as, Ganesh or Vishnu or whoever, But a lot of this stuff, there tends to be a bit of a theme of sacrifice, okay? Like we're not sacrificing like a goat or a lamb or something like this. By the way, in ancient times, sacrifice was very much about that. It was very much about sacrifice some animal. There should be blood. There should be, as much more, very primitive, very animistic. Now, sacrifice, I think, has sort of become over many centuries, and I'd love to hear a John Puna do a talk on this someday about how sacrifice has changed over many centuries. But it tends to get milder and milder as we kind of get more and more modern. These days we're just sacrificing some candles and some incense, and a lot of the chants we do as well, they are extolling virtues. Various virtues that we would ideally have in the holy life or as lay practitioners, virtues like kindness and generosity and diligence and restraint and I could just list so many of these qualities we're trying to develop. And to me, what the ultimate form of sacrifice looks like as you bring it to its almost like its zenith. Of evolving, back from the days of butchering up goats and sheep and whatnot on an altar. To me, what it comes down to now, I think what sacrifice means to us now as Westerners, it's like when you sit on the meditation cushion and meditate, that is sacrifice. You are meditating. You are doing actually one of the highest forms of merit that Buddhism has as you get into deeper and deeper meditations. You make big league merit when your meditation is good. That's big league merit. But it is sacrifice in the sense of like you could have been reading a book. You could have been surfing the web. You could have been watching YouTube. You could have been playing a video game. But no, you sacrificed those fun things that you might have liked to do, those less, wisdom building kind of activities, and you did something that's not easy to do. You sat still on your meditation cushion or your chair. Okay, that is sacrifice. You gave up something fun and easy for something more challenging and even difficult, and even like, for some people, like meditation's really hard, maybe for the first time they try to meditate and like their mind just won't calm down. It won't be quiet. It won't, it's just, they learn about this monkey mind thing. They're like, wow, I can't control this wild monkey, yes, to sit through that and to try to be peaceful and patient and persistent during that. Oh yes, that is sacrifice to, what you would rather be doing, So to me, this is what sacrifice in its highest form ends up looking like. Can we actually meditate? Can we do things like even how about yoga, I call that even a form of sacrifice because, we could just sit in a comfortable chair or have a nap or, a lot of things instead of, whatever it is we find ourselves putting off, even though we know it's good for us. Those are the sacrifices that we would do well to perform. It can come down to like eating healthy too. That too is sacrifice. Like if there's, maybe some healthy broccoli here and some cookies there, well, the tempting thing to do is to eat the cookies, right? But no, we can sacrifice that and we can eat the broccoli. It's healthier. Do we have an opportunity to put something a little healthier in our mouths instead of those cookies? That's sacrifice. So I think a lot of this ritual that is done in these different traditions, where they are extolling all sorts of virtues and they are remembering past, luminaries, especially the Buddha. Even when they're extolling these past luminaries, what were those luminaries good at? Sacrificing. You know what I mean? So I say even that, even to remember people like the Buddha, you're remembering the masters of sacrifice in the various ways that they could do that. And when you become a monk, there's a large pile of things you sacrifice. Like we don't have girlfriends, wives, we don't have love lives, we don't have, there's so many things we have to give up. We don't handle money. We can't just go wherever we like and do whatever we want, That's a tremendous sacrifice. Like when you have money, you can sure do a lot of different things with money, You can go into almost countless numbers of stores and buy almost countless numbers of goods if you can afford it. Okay, well, we sacrifice all of that, like the ability to pick and choose as we wish, Yeah, like there's so many things I used to like to go eat. I can't do that anymore, Particular foods that were my favorite or whatever. No, I had to sacrifice that. So yeah, to me, a lot of these rituals are sort of like trying to almost kind of like encourage us or inspire us to want to sacrifice more, Now, whether we go and do it is another thing. But a lot of these ceremonies are at least sort of like a communal agreement, you might say that, like, well, we all agree that sacrificing is good, to these higher causes, to these skillful things that we know are good for us. We all at least agree that it is, we would do that if we were wise, Maybe not all of us have, let's say, the willpower or the, I don't know what, determination to actually execute that. Some people have more than others. That's understandable. But at least, during those rituals and stuff, everyone will at least acknowledge, yes, this is what the masters can and will do, This is what we agree is the higher behavior which we all praise. We're all on the same page that way. Ceremony can kind of have that value, I think. It's at least an acknowledgement. Even for people who maybe don't meditate, they don't They don't really develop these qualities very much, but at least they can come to these rituals and they're on the same page as to at least what the values are. So that to me does have some value, which I will acknowledge. However, for those of us who can, who can execute, okay, for those of us who can meditate, for those of us who do have these good routines going on in our lives, we maybe do some yoga, we do some exercise, we go for a walk, we get fresh air, we chop our wood, or even cooking, the steward's helping to cook, or however it is we all contribute. All of these are, the very kinds of sacrifices which these ceremonies are extolling. You know what I mean? It is so much better to do it than to just chant about it. You know what I mean? Yeah. So to me, those ceremonies do kind of have a place, but it is so much all the better when we can do it. And so I have a special place in my heart, and I think all of us here as well have this too, where here we are at a forest monastery, okay? And these places are known to be more of a place of practice. Like a lot of the city temples and stuff in Buddhism, a lot of the village temples, a lot of the monks there, they don't really meditate much at all. When you really look at what they do day to day, if you were to observe their daily schedule, okay, they aren't really meditating much at all. Some of them, not at all. But what they do a lot of is ceremony. They are doing lots of chants. They are going to people's houses and blessing them. Some monks even will even go to like weddings and stuff and do chanting there. They're kind of like ceremony performers, some of them. And to kind of tie back to the whole Tibetan thing here, where you see a lot of ceremony, I think that there is this aspect of human nature. And you see this in virtually every religion, by the way. I don't want to pick on the Tibetans here, okay? I'm not looking to make them sound bad or anything. I think that there's a general pattern which we can identify in virtually every modern religion, a long-standing, religion of many centuries that's kind of got like institutionalized, you might almost say, There's this pattern you tend to find where early on in that religion's origins, it was very much about doing some sort of practice or other, doing some sort of striving. You know what I mean? There was actually something you did actively, which made you, have deeper insights or even psychic powers or, you know what I mean? Like deep spiritual experiences. But as time rolls on, as the centuries roll on, more and more of this ceremonial stuff will tend to build up. And the monks, just as it did, remember I was saying how the Buddha was so critical of the Brahmins? That happened with Brahminism too. They used to be these seekers and sages who lived in leaf huts, just primitive leaf huts, and they wore like antelope hides, and they had matted dreadlocks, and they, and they would meditate a lot, and some of them were great psychic masters even, and could it, you know. And I'm pretty convinced they could attain to deeper states of samadhi, maybe not nibbana, but they had some definite skill that the Buddha praised, and then they had almost sort of become, you might say, a little more watered down by the time his time happened, the Buddha, where they were all into ritual, they're into sacrifice, they're into, you know what I mean? They're almost like magicians. They were like magical ceremony performers. And there is this wonderful word that I stumbled across called thaumaturgy. Thaumaturgy. This is kind of a intellectual fancy word, like thaumaturgy, thaumaturgy, which means like the practice of magic and miracles by some sort of holy person. Like a priest, So these ceremonial priests could be called thaumaturges, like a thaumaturge. That's like a I guess an adjective, you know, a yeah, like it's describing a person. They can be a thaumaturge, meaning, yeah, they perform miracles, they perform ceremonies, they perform wonders. Yeah, and I think that this is a general pattern you find in virtually every long-standing kind of institutionalized religion is the, you know, could we say the clergy, you know, like the priests or whatever, the monks, they magic will more and more become the thing that they do for their livelihood, okay? As opposed to the striving and the practices which are in the original old religion. Yeah, like even Christianity, take that for an example. Like Christ went off into the desert, I think it was 40 days and 40 nights, and he lived on like honey and locusts. And, you know, he was like a serious, you know, kind of a spiritual striving kind of a guy out in the desert, you know, and that's when he kind of had a number of huge insights and breakthroughs. Anyway, so that I think will happen to virtually every religion over time, where it becomes more thaumaturgical is what the monks and the priests do. By the way, the Buddha listed a bunch of wrong livelihoods in the Vinaya, things monks aren't allowed to do to make their living. Like they're not allowed to read palms, you know, or do like astrology for people as a form of livelihood, like to earn their food or to earn money or whatever. They're not allowed to you know, kind of like be fortune tellers, this kind of thing. You know, like there were a number of, you might say, thaumaturgical practices which were known at the time of the Buddha. And this isn't necessarily in Brahmanism, but you know, various sorts of fortune tellers and, you know, people who just did astrology and this kind of thing. They would like cast bones and, you know, try to find, what do you call it? Like be able to tell people's fortune from the bones. And, you know, they could look at signs from different animals, you know, like if different birds called out, you know, that was a sign. Or even like rat nibblings, you know, like the way rats would nibble on certain things. Even the little tooth marks of the rat nibblings, they would read that you could tell a fortune from that. They call this rat skills in the Vinaya. Anyway, so the Buddha said, you know, monks are not to make their livelihood from these kinds of, he called them base arts, or even at times called animal knowledge, meaning like all these other spiritual practices are, you know, this is the religion of animals, you know what I mean? Like that's a very derogatory way to say it. I feel that might be a little too harsh to use that term, but it is in there. I'm not sure if the Buddha himself said that, personally. But anyway, so you know, on the one hand, I want to praise and acknowledge the good things about ceremony, okay? Because I see it fulfilling a role in community. Because it can act like a glue, okay? But on the other hand, I wish to point out if that is taken too far, if it is taken to the point where the monks and the priests of the world are making a livelihood off that, they're making a living off that, and they're no longer doing the original practices, the original, you know, the original teachings of the founder, you know, like the Buddha, you know, things like Sila Samadhi Panya, that kind of thing, you know, some like attaining Nibbana, this kind of thing, attaining stages of enlightenment. If they aren't doing that anymore and they're just doing their thaumaturgical stuff, well, they've strayed a long way. You know what I mean? So to me, there is a place where it goes too far, okay? Once it becomes thaumaturgical and they aren't doing those original practices anymore, I feel it has then lost its roots. And I see the Buddha himself harshly ridiculing those Brahmins for losing their roots. Okay, so I actually feel that the Buddha is the sort of person who will call out this losing of roots, because you see him doing it in the suttas, and not once, dozens of times. Sometimes like he just it's I find it highly entertaining. He's so, he's really good at it sometimes. Like anyway, okay, so I should probably bring this to a close saying I appreciate this rich tapestry, okay, that Buddhism is with all these different traditions, and I don't want to, cast shade on them because I see that they provide a lot of goodness to their communities in various ways. They do serve a role which can be praised when they bring a community together and they can encourage all these good qualities, things like, like I was saying, generosity and restraint and caring and metta and all this good stuff. I'm all for that. But once it drifts too far into thaumaturgy, it's then I don't know how to pull back the reins on that, but what I will say is you see the Buddha calling that out and he does not hold back the punches. I mean that figuratively. He's never violent by punching, but you know what I mean. He makes them look like fools several times, Yeah, and he's direct about it. Okay, so yeah, maybe that is where maybe I should leave this off. And thank you so much for listening. I leave this for your reflection.